Hello again, and welcome back to the Slow Flowers Podcast with Deborah Prinzing, episode 276. This is the weekly podcast about American flowers and the people who grow and design with them. It's all about making a conscious choice, and I invite you to join the conversation and the creative community as we discuss the vital topics of saving our domestic flower farms and supporting a floral industry that relies on a safe, seasonal, and local supply of flowers and foliage. This podcast is brought to you by slowflowers.com, the free nationwide online directory to florists, shops, and studios who design with American-grown flowers, and to the farms that grow those blooms. It's the conscious choice for buying and sending flowers. First of all, happy winter solstice. You may be celebrating tonight with a garden walk, a concept proposed by Sue Nevler, a Seattle friend of mine who is active in the American public garden community. The idea she has is that we light a candle and take a nighttime walk in a garden with others as a peaceful gathering of community. By extension, I'm suggesting we celebrate solstice in cotton gardens and on flower farms. If today is the first you've heard of her suggestion, click on over to DeborahPrinzing.com, where you will find more details at the show notes for episode 276. I'm delighted to share a very special holiday episode with you today, and I hope it feeds your spirit as much as it has mine. Last year's holiday episode featured musician, songwriter, flower farmer Dennis Westfall of Jellamold Farm in Mount Vernon, Washington. In case you missed that spirited program in which Dennis played some of his original songs and sang for us, I've added a link at today's show notes so you can go back and listen to that. I worried for a while that Dennis and his music would be a hard act to follow, but then my friend Ellen Zakos agreed to join me today, sharing her lovely vocals and the story of her love affair with plants. I'm so pleased that she said yes when I asked. I first learned about Ellen in the pages of Harvard Magazine, which my husband Bruce receives each month as an alumni. It was probably a dozen years ago when Harvard profiled one of its alums, a New Hampshire native who had moved to New York City after graduation and joined the stage, and also studied horticulture at the New York Botanic Garden. Ellen is possibly the only cast member of Les Miserables who has also run a planting design business that served Manhattan's elite owners of rooftop greenhouses. What a wonderful story, and I couldn't wait to meet her. Since the garden writing world is as intimate and interconnected as the slow flowers world, it didn't take long for Ellen and me to meet together. I'm not sure when we actually connected, but I'm guessing it was more than a decade ago at a garden writer's symposium. We later became fellow board members and had years of meetings to bring us together. Today, you will hear more of her amazing story and enjoy her music, my holiday gift to you. Ellen's journey from theater to horticulture to her current platform as the top backyard foraging expert will wow you. Here's a little more about my friend. On her website, Ellen writes, "I moved to New York City sometime in the last century to be an actor. I know, it's an age-old story. Small town girl moves to New York City, lands a role on Broadway, decides she'd rather be a horticulturist, and starts her own garden design, installation, and maintenance business. You've heard it many times before. But seriously, after leaving the cast of Les Mis on Broadway, I went back to school at the New York Botanic Garden and earned certificates in both ornamental horticulture and ethnobotany. For many years, I taught at NYBG on a wide range of subjects and ran my rooftop gardening business, Acme Plant Stuff. Isn't that a great name, Acme Plant Stuff? As I learned more about the plants I was using, I noticed that many traditional ornamental plants had edible and medicinal histories. I wondered why we didn't eat hostas anymore, and people planted hopniss for its flowers rather than its delicious potato-like tubers. Gradually, my emphasis shifted from plants that were merely ornamental to plants that fed both body and soul, the eyes and the stomach. I started out foraging in the garden because that's where I could identify the plants and I knew they were safe from potentially dangerous insecticides and herbicides. Soon, I ventured out into the wilds of Central Park, the woods of Pennsylvania, the deserts of New Mexico, the islands of Scotland, and the gorges of Greece. In other words, I'm always looking for delicious, free food. As the longtime foraging expert at About.com, Ellen has shared seasonal recipes and tips on foraging for years. She also works with Remy Martin USA, teaching foraging mixology workshops across the U.S., and she's currently working on a book about foraged cocktails due out in 2017. I love this line from her blog at backyardforager.com. She writes, "I want to get you hooked on wild edibles, so maybe next time you'll be sitting in that car with me when I pull over to harvest burdock flower stems, because so much of the joy of foraging is sharing it with someone who also appreciates the flavors and the adventure." The author of six previous books, including Backyard Foraging, 65 Familiar Plants You Didn't Know You Could Eat, Orchid Growing for Wimps, and Growing Healthy Houseplants, Ellen also writes a monthly column for the National Gardening Association, and she is the senior advisor for New England for Garden Compass, the number one rated iTunes gardening app. She loves to teach and is a frequent lecturer at botanic gardens, flower shows, and for garden clubs around the world. Ellen's show business background taught her how to engage an audience, and she combines this natural skill with years of practical experience and plenty of book learning. A longtime instructor at the New York Botanical Garden, Ellen recently moved to Santa Fe, New Mexico, which means she splits time between the desert Southwest and the lush Northeast. It's quite a contrast, botanically speaking, and one that keeps her learning new plants as well as new ways to eat them. Today's episode will feature a conversation between two professional colleagues who greatly admire one another, and you'll hear the warmth of friendship in our voices. Ellen will tell us her floral and foraging narrative. She'll share tips for backyard foraging, perhaps even a recipe for a favorite foraged winter cocktail. And here's the extra special treat. Our conversation will be interspersed with cuts from Ellen's CD, Green Up Time, a tribute to botanical Broadway. Don't you just love that? We're going to hear songs that Ellen recorded that come from famous Broadway musicals and show tunes. Please enjoy our conversation and check out DeborahPrinzing.com for episode 276 to see photos, find links, and learn more about this incredibly gifted human being. And if you're looking for the perfect gift for the gardener or flower lover in your life, there's definitely still time to order Green Up Time as a CD or downloadable MP3 album at online stores. I am so excited to introduce you, Ellen Zakos, backyard foraging expert, author, speaker, mixologist, and you've got a great story, and I know my listeners will want to hear it. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you, and thank you so much for having me on.
Well, it's really fun because you have one of those, mini lives, mini careers as those of us in communications and creativity often do. And you've agreed to let us play some of the songs that are in the recording of your CD, which is called Green Up Time. And it's basically Botanical Broadway is the subtext to that, right?
Yeah, that was kind of the project that bridged my two lives. And talking about it kind of makes me want to go back and do like a volume two, but my first career was on Broadway. I was in Les Mis, I was in falsettos, and then gradually became more passionate about horticulture, but I still really loved to sing. And since my husband is a very talented recording engineer, making a CD was really a fun project for us to do together, and it was a great experience.
Well, that CD is still available. I just reordered it on Amazon and downloaded the audio because my CD, my actual original CD from Ellen, is somewhere in a box, part of my move. But I'm going to play a few. We'll play a few songs as we take breaks in our conversation. And the first one we have to start with is "I Always Say Hello to a Flower." So, Ellen, are you a soprano? Well, your voice is really like elegant and high. I could never hit those notes.
Oh, thank you. I'm not sure I can hit them anymore either. You know, it's like a muscle. It's like you have to be an athlete. If you had been a fantastic tennis player and didn't pick up a racket for 5 years, you would have to work to get those shots back. And I would have to work to get those notes back. Although I do believe I still could hit them. I think I never really thought of myself as a soprano. I sort of thought of myself as what we called a high belter, which sort of like the modern stuff like Ava in Evita and it's got more, I don't know, more chest in it, but it's higher notes, if that makes any sense to you.
Yeah. Well, before we play this song, I have to ask you about getting to Broadway. So what drew you there after college? Was it the acting, the singing, or the dancing, or all of it?
It was definitely not the dancing, Deborah. Definitely not the dancing. I've always been able to remember the choreography really well. I just can't do it. I'm probably a better dancer than many people who haven't been in theater, but I was always a singer who moves well. And, the singing and the acting were both equally appealing to me, but if I had to choose just one, I think it would be the singing. I just love music, but I honestly believe that to be a truly good singer, you must also be an actor, because nobody cares if just the notes are pretty. You've got to be able to convey some feeling with the music.
Okay. Well, we'll hear I Always Say Hello to a Flower. And there'll be more details about each of these songs from the liner notes in Green Up Time at the show notes for DeborahPrinzing.com.
Some people talk to each other while others talk to their cats. Some people talk to their mothers while others talk through their hats. I communicate with nature, with a leaf, a plant, a tree. And I'm always nice to a flower, for they're perfectly lovely to me. I always say hello to a flower. Hello, hello, hello. I totally ignore the crashing bore who lives next door, for her conversation's silly, yet I'd never snub a lily. I always say bonjour to a lilac. Bonjour, lilac, bonjour. I'm absolutely mute with a bully in a suit, but I often talk to fruit, heaven knows. And I always say hello to a rose. Yes, I'll surely wave at a window box if that box is filled with hollyhocks. And I speak to the daisies, I think they're swell. Tell your secret to a daisy, they'll never tell. I always say hello to a snowball. Hello, snowball, hello. Look sideways at a stranger and you put your life in danger. But one can kiss a sweet bouquet a blushing bride has tossed away. Flowers are the sweetest things I know. So when I see a flower, I say hello. I never shrink away from a violet. Oh no, I say hello. I may be off my rocker, but I'd never pet a cocker. Yet the dogwood in the park will never ever bite or bark. I'm always glad to see a gladiola. I'm mad about a glad. You can stand next to a bush and you'll never feel one push. Flowers are refined and polite. I've never seen a crocus fight. Yes, I've talked to bees and I've talked to birds, but they leave me quite at a loss for words. And I won't touch a cat while it sleeps on a pillow, yet I positively trust a pussy willow. I always say hello to a flower. Hi there, yes you, hello. Get friendly with a mouse and it hangs around the house. But flowers never overstay. They stay a day, then fade away. Flowers are the sweetest things I know. So when I see a flower, I say, today. And is that a new perfume you're wearing? Because it is sweet. You know, I've got a vase at my apartment right up on the mantelpiece, and I'm telling you, it is just your style. What do you say we go back to my place, and I'll show you my floral snips?
Thanks, Ellen. That was so beautiful. I got a big smile on my face. Now, I have to just ask you about this transition from Broadway to horticulture. Did everyone in your world think you were like nuts when you decided to go to horticulture school while also performing?
Pretty much, yes. you know, interestingly, I had started studying horticulture because I was interested in it. I had been given a plant as an opening night gift instead of a bouquet of flowers and started to grow a lot of plants for myself. And then Goodspeed Opera House, I wish I could remember what the name of the show was, but they had me back for one callback and another callback. And instead of being excited, all I could think of was, what am I going to do about my greenhouse clients? Because I was working for a couple people with private greenhouses, and I realized my priorities had truly shifted, and I didn't want to leave my greenhouse clients, that plants had come to mean more to me than performing did. So it kind of snuck up on me, the transition.
That's interesting. And I guess living in New York City, you yourself mostly had houseplants and your clients mostly had houseplants. So it's sort of a different type of horticulture. It needed a little bit more daily input, probably. You couldn't just leave for a week.
No, ultimately, I could leave for a week because I, you know, got them all set up with automatic irrigation. But yes, it started out with houseplants because I was in New York City. And that's also how my specialty evolved, which was the rooftop gardens. You know, it's a very different kind of gardening than gardening in the ground. And I grew to really love the restrictions and the criteria that were imposed upon me by gardening 20 floors above street level. That was really fun for me.
Yeah, I think when I first met you, you had just written or were working on a book on orchids and then a book on amazing tropical plants. And it was such a focused, kind of expression in your own photography and in your writing and your teaching at that point, right?
Right. Right. I taught at the New York Botanical Garden for many years.
Mm-hmm. Well, you studied at the New York Botanic Garden originally, right?
I did. I went to school there and earned several certificates. And then I started teaching there. And for a while, I was the coordinator of the gardening program in continuing education. And then, of course, when I moved to Santa Fe, New Mexico, teaching in New York was no longer a viable alternative. So that relationship ended.
Yeah, but I remember for years you were the go-to person at New York Botanic Garden. And I remember one year you invited me to come be part of some amazing like plant-focused
lecture series. That's right. Yep.
Yeah. So what a great kind of place to develop your knowledge and also kind of you already were obviously a great public persona as a performer and then it pivoted to using those same skills as a teacher, I would imagine.
You know, it really did. And sometimes I look back and I think, oh, wow, I wish I'd known how much I loved botany, how much I loved horticulture earlier in my life so that I could have learned more and done more. But I honestly think that having been a performer makes me a better teacher and a better lecturer and helps me relate to the audience in a way that not everybody can because they just haven't done it quite as much. So ultimately, it's a nice combination of skills for me.
Yeah, it's great. It's funny. I look at the successful wedding and event producers who all came out of theater. They know how to put on a show. And clearly, you know how to put on a show, but you have a lot of substance and inspire people to learn through, you know, a more engaging experience in the classroom rather than something dull and technical.
Well, thank you. I think that's, you've summed it up what I try to do exactly.
Well, I want to play the title song of your CD, Green Up Time. And the cover of your CD is so beautiful. It's this wonderful little fern unfurling. It's just so appropriate. What is the story about this song? Why did it appeal to you?
Well, exactly for that reason. I'm talking to you right now from our home in Pennsylvania, and we really are in the middle of the woods, surrounded by an ocean of ferns during the growing season. And everybody comes here and they expect to see a wonderful garden. And of course, my garden is not wonderful. It's the old, you know, the cobbler's kids go barefoot thing. I was gardening every day of the week for other people. And the last thing I wanted to do on the weekends was work in my own garden. But we were surrounded by these ferns. And every time people would come, they would say, "Oh my gosh, I love those ferns so much." Something I had nothing to do with. Something that I was just very fortunate to have be there. And they're gorgeous when they're just coming up in the spring. They are lush and green and billowing during the summer. And then in the fall, they turn this wonderful yellow color. So for me, those ferns are really a symbol of this place in the Pennsylvania woods that I love so much. Mm. So,
good.
So that's why I took that photo, and it just kind of symbolizes that very beginning of spring when things are just starting to green up.
Right. And here in the dead of winter, we're all just having visions of ferns unfurling in our heads. So this is appropriate. Okay. We're going to listen to Green Up Time.
Yesterday morning, I did see blossoms on the apple tree. I took a breath and thought, could it be, it's green up time. Then I began to look around, and in every field I found, greens were a-pushing up through the ground for green up time. And sure enough, the bluebells tinkled April in the glen. And sure enough, I fell in love with love again. Then I started feeling awfully bright, had a thought that hit me right. I'll have my honey dance me tonight and have a time to welcome in the green of time.
Okay, thanks, Ellen. That was another one that just puts a huge smile on my face. And because we're talking about ferns and the woods of Pennsylvania, where you and Michael also have a place, I get the sense that that's where your backyard foraging kind of began. Is that correct? Or
you know, I think yes. It's certainly, I do a lot of foraging here in Pennsylvania, but people are surprised when I tell them that I really started foraging in New York City.
What?
Because, I know. Central Park is got an amazing variety of plants and noxious weeds. So much of what I forage for are weeds that are very aggressive with their growth habits. So, you know, nobody minds if you're picking Japanese knotweed. They actually should be thanking me for doing that. So I really started to forage in Central Park. And then the more I learned and the more I explored, the more I started doing it in other places as well. And Pennsylvania is really a forager's paradise.
Mm. So what can you derive from Japanese knotweed that is edible? Or is that just an example of a weed that everyone wants to get rid of?
Well, it's actually both, I think. Japanese knotweed is an excellent edible plant, and it can be used either as a rhubarb substitute or as a sorrel substitute because it's got that tart flavor to it. So I use it as a stir-fried vegetable. I use it in like a strawberry rhubarb pie. I also, it's weird because when you cook it, the juice is a very pretty pink color. but the stems are green with just very faint pink markings. So I make a syrup from it, which then is a great mixer to put with whiskey or bourbon. It's got a really nice tart flavor and a very pretty pink color.
I'm so interested in the color about, I hadn't known that. And there's so many people now who are searching for plants to use for natural dyes, like for textiles. I wonder if that would be something to play around with.
It might be. I know nothing about dyes except that, you know, my hands are black after I touch black walnuts, but I don't know anything about dyeing yarn or cloth with any plants.
No, you're focused on what we can put in our mouths, and I love that.
it's all about being delicious. Yeah.
Okay, I want to play a song from "On a Clear Day You Can See Forever." It's called "Hurry, It's Lovely Up Here." You reminded me that the famous Barbara Streisand originally sang this. So, or I don't know if she originally sang it, but sang it in the film or on stage. I'm not sure. No pressure or anything, right?
Right. Yeah. Please don't compare me to Barbara Streisand. She's, you know, a goddess and I'm a mere mortal, but I do love the song. It's really, I think it's very clever.
Oh, okay, great. Well, we'll enjoy this. Go ahead and get it started.
Hey, buds below, up is where to grow, up with which below can't compare with. Hurry, it's lovely up here. Life down the hole takes an awful toll. What with not a soul there to share with? Hurry, it's lovely up here. Wake up, bestir yourself. It's time that you disinter yourself. You've got a spot to fill, a pot to fill. And what a gift package of shower, sun, and love. You'll be met above everywhere with, fondled and sniffed by millions who drift by.
Okay, Ellen, I think you can be number two goddess, okay?
Thank you, Deb.
So you mentioned foraging in Central Park, but how did the foraging kind of take over your life and become, in a way, your new brand after your kind of houseplant, greenhouse, you know, kind of tropicals, orchids brand? Because that was sort of originally how I met you.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, it did. At first, it was really houseplants and tropicals. I am not somebody who believes in fate or says, oh, this is the way it was always supposed to work out. But when I think about foraging, I think it was just lying dormant in me, and I didn't even realize it. But it's for me the perfect combination of plants, which I love, and food, which I love even more. And then, you know, it's free and it's an adventure and you never know what you're going to find. You might go out looking for blueberries and come home with mushrooms, or there's a spontaneity about it. There's an excitement about it. And it also gets you outdoors walking around, and there's really nothing about it that I don't love.
Well, I think your niche is really interesting, that your focus originally with your most recent book, Backyard Foraging, because I think there is this fear factor that I myself would have and many people would have about not knowing what's in the wild, but the cultivated garden is a little bit tamer for, but who would think that any of that stuff's edible, right? And that's your the surprise element that you're teaching people.
Yeah, that is it. And that's exactly, I wanted to start with familiar plants so that people wouldn't have to worry about going out into the wild and identifying something that they might make a mistake with. But, you know, everybody knows they're growing hostas in their backyard or daylilies or dahlias. So let's start with those things that you already recognize. You're growing in your own yard, so you know it hasn't been sprayed with anything terrible. You know, there's no 18-wheelers driving by making pollution that's going to be absorbed by your plants. It's a really safe way to start. And it's kind of, it's like how I'm tricking you into getting interested in this subject. I'm trying to hook you.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I think it kind of emerged at the same time when, issues about food safety and food security and the origins of the food we eat all became top of mind. For me personally, I always felt a little guilty only wanting to garden ornamentals. Like somehow I was like a lightweight or something. And here you're giving me permission to grow anything because you're curious and you're helping me discover that maybe some of those flowers are edible, not just the flowers, but other parts of the plant as well.
Right, right. And, you know, especially, I don't know if you have to dig up dahlias where you are. You might not. They might be winter hardy.
Well, it's, some people do, though, because our soil is clay and it's just so, so easy to rot the dahlia tubers then. Yeah.
But this time of year in the Northeast, everybody's digging up their dahlias anyway. So that's a really good one to get people started with, because if you dig up your tubers and bring them indoors, you know, take one of those tubers into the kitchen and peel it and grate it. And there's so many different ways you can use it. And that's like a really good gateway plant to get people started thinking about the edible aspects of some of these ornamental plants.
I love it. Well, let's listen to another song with a flower theme. And by the way, I should say the CD has something like 20 songs, and there's all kinds of genre of music, as well as garden imagery, flower imagery, nature imagery. So I've kind of cherry-picked the flower-themed songs. I hope that's okay.
Yes, it's what I had hoped for and expected. So thank you.
Okay, so the flower garden of my heart, I looked it up, and it's the internet told me that it was from the Broadway musical Pal Joey. So let's listen to it.
In the flower garden of my heart, I've got daisies to tell you you're true. Oh, the west wind will whisk us the scent of hibiscus and heather.
Great big yacht, but I'm contented with my lot. I've got one thing much more beautiful and grand. I do not own a racing horse. That doesn't fill me with remorse. I possess the finest show place in the land. So come with me and wander to a lovely spot out yonder, in the flower garden of my heart. I've got violets as blue as your eyes. I've got dainty narcissus as sweet as my missus, and lilies as pure as the sky.
In the flower garden of my heart,
I've got roses as red as your mouth.
Just to keep our love holy, I've got gladioli
and sunflowers fresh from the south.
But you are the artist and love.
Do you have a favorite number on this CD, or is that like asking you what your favorite mushroom is?
It's harder than saying what my favorite mushroom is. Although, you know, I have different favorites for different reasons, but one of my favorites is Misalliance by Flanders and Swann for a couple reasons. First of all, because you really have to pay attention to the lyrics. They're really smart and funny. And it's also a song that a lot of people don't know. It's not the most beautiful song on the CD, but to me, it's probably the most entertaining.
Yeah, we're going to play that next. And I love listening to the witty lyrics. And as a vocalist, is that a completely different level of concentration required when you're singing a song with such kind of fast-changing and also difficult lyrics?
Well, you do absolutely have to have a good memory for those lyrics. But I think the most fun in that particular song is all the different accents. That was the fun part for me.
Yes. Oh, I know. It's great. You sound like a snobbish person from another continent. I don't want to name anybody's ethnicity.
Right.
Let's listen to that while we're talking about it. Misalliance.
Okay.
The fragrant honeysuckle spirals clockwise to the sun, and many other creepers do the same. But some climb counterclockwise, the bindweed does, for one, or convolvulus, to use her proper name. Rooted on either side of the door, one of each species grew, and raced up to the window ledge above. Each corkscrew to the lintel in the only way it knew, where they stopped, touched tendrils, smiled, and fell in love. The right-handed honeysuckle to the left-handed bindweed, oh, let us get married, if our parents don't mind. We'd be loving and inseparable, inextricably entwined. We'd live happily ever after, said the honeysuckle to the bindweed. To the honeysuckle's parents it came as a shock. Bindweeds, they cried, are inferior stock. They're uncultivated, of breeding bereft. We twine to the right, and they twine to the left. Said the counterclockwise bindweed to the clockwise honeysuckle, we better start saving, our resolve mustn't buckle. Run away on a nanny moon, and hope that our luck'll take a turn for the better, said the bindweed to the honeysuckle. to them then. I've said it before and I'll say it again. Consider your offshoots, if offshoots there be. They'll never receive any blessing from me. Poor little sucker, how will it learn when it is climbing which way to turn? Right, left, what a disgrace, or it may go straight up and fall flat on its face. Said the right-hand thread honeysuckle to the left-hand thread bindweed, it seems that against us all fate has combined. Oh, my darling, oh, my darling, oh, my darling Columbine. Thou art lost and gone forever. We shall never intertwine. Together they found them the very next day. They had pulled up their roots and just shriveled away. Deprived of that freedom for which we must fight, to veer to the left or to veer to the right.
I don't know, maybe I should print the lyrics of that particular song in the show notes so people can actually go back and read them. I'll pull a little excerpt because
that's a good idea, because it might be hard to get them all. You know,
well, but this is thing about the bindweed and the what's the companion plant?
The honeysuckle. Yes, and the honeysuckle being a valued ornamental plant, and the bindweed being a noxious weed. The family of the honeysuckle looks down on the bindweed and doesn't want the honeysuckle to marry the bindweed, but the true lovers will prevail.
Yeah, it's almost like symbolic of the class war or something like that. Society.
Well, that was my idea. Those to put the accents with each plant. So, there you go. I'm patting myself on the back here.
I love it. Okay, so I have had many wonderful experiences with you, often over food and drinks.
Yes.
I'm really mad that you're not living in New York City anymore, because you were always good for a date when I would come to town, and you even hosted me on many occasions, which was really lovely. I'm glad you're in Santa Fe now, because now I can come visit you there. I have a vivid memory, one of my favorites, of sitting in your kitchen in Santa Fe where you live now, and you pulled out this gorgeous, very large bottle of liquor, or spirits, I guess, called The Botanist. I want you to tell everybody about this and how, what an interesting turn your backyard foraging career has taken with a partnership with The Botanist.
Yeah, The Botanist is a dry gin made on Isla, an island off the west coast of Scotland. And Michael and I were actually there for our 25th wedding anniversary. And I saw The Botanist behind the bar and I thought, well, I like gin and I'm a botanist. I guess I should try that. And I did. And it was a very, very tasty gin. But I couldn't find it in the United States. And about a year later, the people from The Botanist gin, which is a brand that's owned by Remy, contacted me. They had seen my backyard foraging book, and The Botanist is made from 22 foraged botanicals found on Isla. And they wanted to work with the whole idea of foraged mixology, and they hired me to develop a program, and they've sent me all over the country teaching mixologists how to use foraged ingredients in their cocktails. So it really plays into the whole idea of local and seasonal, and the botanist cocktail that you make in the Pacific Northwest is going to be very different from the botanist cocktail that you make in Miami, Florida, simply because the local and seasonal plants that you find for flavors are so different in those places. Well, they're fantastic to work with. I love the product, and it's been so great learning so much from the mixologists. I know my job is to teach them things, but I learned so much about mixology from these great people that I met. That's been really wonderful.
Well, I, first of all, I'm so excited that this sort of crossover industry has embraced you, because as you and I have talked many times, you can't make a living just writing garden articles. You have to find innovative, you know, ways to be relevant in other markets. And I mean, I've obviously been drawn into the floral industry. Your partnership with the mixology world is so fascinating. When you served that botanist to me, I believe you just poured it over ice because you wanted me to really taste those elemental bits of foraged, you know, this and that. What is in that gin? Is it juniper or something?
There are two different kinds of juniper berry. One is the Juniperus communis that's common to many different gins, but then they also use the fruit of a very very specific juniper that grows on Isla. It's a low growing juniper that you're not going to find everywhere. But they have a couple different mints in there. There are, you know, I should pull the bottle out right now so I can could look at it. There are gorse flowers. I'm blanking on all the things.
That's
that
okay.
Are
the reason I think the cool thing is the reason you were suggesting you should look at the bottle is these names are all embedded like raised letters on the surface of the bottle. It's like a collect. I want that bottle just for to be a collector's item.
Yeah, people go nuts over the bottle. And what's especially nice is, and I loved this, they give all the Latin names for the plants. You know.
Yes.
It's great to use common names in conversation, but if you're foraging and you have to be absolutely 100% sure that you've got the right plant and not a relative that might be less delicious or even less safe, the Latin name is very important. And so they've got all of the Latin names on the plants, and I was very happy about that.
So how do you do this, Ellen? You fly into a city, because I remember you came to Seattle to teach. And by the way, these are not for the public. These are for the pros. You're working with bartenders, right?
I am. These are for mixologists. We're talking about maybe doing some public events next year, but right now these are all for mixologists. So I'm teaching like the biggest, the most influential mixologists in every market. 10 or 15 will come to these classes, and we will make bitters with local ingredients, and we'll do some syrups, and we'll pickle something. And then they take that information back to their bars, and we'll work it into the menu.
Wow, that is phenomenal. Well, I hope that I kind of was hoping that you would share one of your cocktail recipes with our listeners. I guess they're readers too; they see it on the blog. But with our audience, that might. I know you said that there's lots of geographic differences, but maybe one that it uses some ingredient that is easy to find, especially in the winter.
Well, you know what. I was going to give you a botanist recipe, but then you said in the winter. So I'm not going to give you a gin recipe. I'm going to tell you something that I think almost everybody can find crab apples, right?
Right.
Okay. So I have been finding crab apples, and I make a syrup out of the crab apple juice. And you can flavor it. The flavoring of the syrup can vary from place to place. For example, when I do it in Santa Fe, I use maybe chipotle peppers. When I do it in the Northeast, I might use wild ginger stolons or spice bush berries. So I make this spiced crabapple syrup, and I take a half an ounce of that and put it in a shaker of ice with 2 ounces of bourbon, shake it up really well, strain it into a champagne coupe or a small glass, and depending on how strong you like your cocktails, you might add a half an ounce of seltzer or an ounce of seltzer or 2 ounces, depending on how you like yours. I tend to put just the tiniest little bit of seltzer.
And it's, that would be my choice too.
Go for it. It's a really great combination. The tartness of the fruit, the crab apples, plays against the sweetness and the natural sweetness in the bourbon really well. And in fact, my sister asked me to do a cocktail at Thanksgiving, and that was what I did. And she said, I don't like brown liquors, but I loved this cocktail. So I think if you think you don't like bourbon or whiskey, this might be a good one to try.
And then you're adding a little bit of spice from whatever is the perhaps regional source of something with a little fire to it, right?
Yeah. And I know that in the Pacific Northwest, West, you have a wild ginger that's Acerum caudatum. Here we have Acerum canadense, and the stolons of that make a wonderful spice. I don't know if you have spice bush berries where you are, but...
Our listeners in the Northeast can find that, though.
Yes, and the Midwest. It grows really to the Mississippi, and it grows beyond that. You just might not find it naturally, but it's a very much appreciated ornamental plant in the landscape because it produces lovely, delicate yellow flowers in spring before the leaves emerge. So a lot of people just grow it as an ornamental, never realizing that the fruit is so tasty.
Mm. You have so much plant knowledge, and I guess I should send people to some of your online sources for inspiration. Can you share those websites of where people can find you and your expertise?
Sure. My own website is www.backyardforager.com, that has been up and running for about 6 months now, and more content every day.
Okay.
I wrote the foraging website for about.com. So foraging.about.com also has a ton of recipes and a lot of plant profiles. They're not adding to it anymore, but there's a lot of information there.
There's a whole archive there because I was subscribing to it and almost every day I would get something from you.
Yeah.
That was very much attuned to the seasons and what you might forage for and then what to do with it in the kitchen.
Exactly.
Excellent. Okay, we're going to listen to two more songs before we wrap up. And this one is talking about putting a smile on my face. This is Grow For Me from Little Shop of Horrors. And I can picture where I was when I first heard this song. You performed in Little Shop of Horrors, you said.
I did. I played the role of Audrey in Little Shop of Horrors at the Alhambra Dinner Theater in Jacksonville, Florida. It was one of my first, I know. It was one of my very first Equity Union gigs. And even though that dinner theater does not exist anymore, I really had a great time there. It was a really fun show to do. Where were you when you first heard this song? I'm curious now.
I think I was in college, and I can picture the theater I was sitting in, and it was somewhere in Seattle. So I just, that was so risque and so edgy in its day. And it's kind of just campy now, right?
It is, but the reason that the show stays popular is because it has heart. And even though the characters are very campy and almost cartoonish, if that's all they were, you wouldn't care. So even though I was standing there with, the push-up bra of the century and this platinum blonde bouffant wig and a very, very short mini dress, you're also singing from the heart about things you really want and things that really matter. And that's what makes a good show, I think.
That's really a great picture. All right, let's listen to Grow For Me.
I've given you sunshine. I've given you dirt.
it. Thank you so much. Now, Ellen, you said this, of course, is sung by Seymour in the actual stage production, but I love that you kind of channeled Seymour in this song.
Thanks.
Before we wrap up, I want to just talk a little bit about your new book. And it seems like, it's coming out in the spring of 2017, and I'll have a link at the show notes for at deborahprinzing.com for people to pre-order it. You've worked on this book, I feel like it's a summation of your lifetime, but really in the last couple of years, right?
Yeah, you know, I had some recipes for cocktails and homemade wines in backyard foraging, and that's how the people at the Botanist Gin found me. And then when I started working for them, and I mentioned before how much I learned from the different mixologists that I worked with, I got to be really obsessively interested in cocktails. So this book was sort of the natural outgrowth of that interest of mine. And I use a lot of different spirits in this book, and I traveled all over the country so that I would have plants that you can find native to San Diego, native to Seattle, Washington, from all over. So there will be something for everybody in this book. And if you, you know, also I got to say, I didn't take the photos, but they are gorgeous. So even if you're not going to go out there and forage and make these drinks, or even if that's what you think, when you see these pictures, you might be inspired because they did some great artwork.
So it's called The Wild Crafted Cocktail, Make Your Own Foraged Syrups, Bitters, Infusions, and Garnishes with recipes for 45 one-of-a-kind mixed drinks. I'm so sorry you had to work so hard on that book. It must have killed you.
It was, you know, you joke. You jest, Deborah. But it was a lot of work. And if you ask my husband, in our house, I get up very early and he gets up at a more normal hour. So he would stumble into the kitchen at 8 o'clock in the morning looking for his first cup of coffee. And I would have four cocktails on the counter. And I'm like, okay, taste this one. And now this one. What do you think of this one? Because, you know, you have to say, well, does sassafras syrup, is it good with bourbon or rye or half bourbon and half rye? Or better with whiskey? And you have to try them so many different ways before you know which direction the cocktail is going to take. It was fun work.
You had to test the recipes.
Yes.
I love it. Yeah. I love that. And just kind of the idea that backyard foraging is maybe a gateway to get people interested in gardening. The Wildcrafted Cocktail is another gateway to get people interested in gardening. And, perhaps, you know, appealing to a different sensory desire, but it's going to really excite people, I think, and have them look at their backyards in a totally different way, I think.
I hope so. I really hope it does. That would make me very happy.
Okay, so you just have to hint at this, an ingredient in the Wildcrafted Cocktail. You must have flowers in some of the recipes.
Yes, I do have flowers in many of the recipes. And now, of course, I can't think of a single one. I'm trying to decide.
Oh. That's all right. We'll let everybody know when the book comes out.
Yeah, no, here's a good one. Milkweed is a plant that has many edible parts, but the flowers produce a really delicious nectar. So I've done a simple syrup infused with milkweed flowers, which goes into a cocktail called the Butterfly Kiss, because of course monarchs have an affinity for milkweed flowers as well. Pineapple weed, which is certainly not an ornamental flower, but is a flower that is common in schoolyards and by roadsides, and the flower has the most wonderful pineapple scent to it when you crush it, and that translates really well into a cocktail. Wild plum flowers that I harvested in Denver, the scent of those wild plum flowers is very nicely captured by sugar and by a syrup. So I use a lot of flowers in this book.
Oh, I love it. Well, then, of course, the audience of the Slow Flowers podcast must embrace the Wildcrafted Cocktail, the
yes.
backyard for and backyard foraging.
Yeah.
Ellen, I adore you. I love knowing you in my life and also just witnessing what you're doing as a creative individual who's always curious. And you're like a lifetime student and a lifetime teacher. And I think that inspires everybody to perhaps learn something new and try to, you know, integrate it into their own professional creative lives. It's a certainly a good way to live your life, and it's been fun to watch it evolve for you. Thank you so much for just being here and sharing your story with everyone.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for being interested and for having me on. And it's nice to know that you appreciate the same kinds of things.
Well, let's go out with a classic song. Many people know it as Inch by Inch, but I guess the actual title is Make Our Garden Grow. You reminded me that Pete Seeger used to sing it, and it was kind of known as a children's song, but it's a perfect way to go out at the end of this episode hearing Ellen Zakos from Green Up Time, a tribute to Botanical Broadway. And Ellen, I will share all your social places and ways for people to find you at the show notes for this episode 277. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Deb.
Let dreamers dream what worlds they please. Those Edens can't be found. The sweetest flowers, the fairest trees are grown in solid ground. We're neither pure nor wise nor good. We'll do the best we know. We'll build our house and chop our wood and make our
thanks so much for joining me today, and happy holidays. Please find resources, photos, links, and that recipe at deborahprinzing.com for episode 276, which is where our show notes reside. The Slow Flowers podcast has been downloaded more than 140,000 times by listeners like you. Thank you to each one of you for downloading, listening, commenting, and sharing. It means so much. Thank you to our lead sponsor for 2016, Certified American Grown Flowers. The Certified American Grown program and label provide a guarantee for designers and consumers on the source of their flowers. Take pride in your flowers and buy with confidence. Ask for Certified American Grown Flowers. To learn more, visit AmericanGrownFlowers.org. More sponsor thanks goes to Syndicate Sales, an American manufacturer of vases and accessories for the professional florist. Look for the American flag icon to find Syndicate's USA-made products and join the Syndicate Stars loyalty program at syndicatesales.com. A big bouquet of thanks goes to Longfield Gardens, providing home gardeners with high-quality flower bulbs and perennials. Their online store offers plants for every region and every season, from tulips and daffodils to dahlias, caladiums, and amaryllis. Visit them at lfgardens.com. A fine thank you to Arctic Alaska Peonies, a cooperative of 50 family farms in the heart of Alaska, providing high-quality American-grown peony flowers during the months of July and August. Visit them at arcticalaskapeonies.com. And finally, thank you, Association of Specialty Cut Flower Growers. Formed in 1988, ASCFG was created to educate, unite, and support commercial cut flower growers. Its mission is to help growers produce high-quality floral material and to foster and promote the local availability of that product. Learn more at ascfg.org. I'm Deborah Prinzing, host and producer of the Slow Flowers Podcast. Next week, you're invited to join me in putting more American-grown flowers on the table, one vase at a time. And if you like what you hear, please consider logging on to iTunes and posting a listener review. The content and opinions expressed here are either mine alone or those of my guests alone, independent of any podcast sponsor or other person, company, or organization. The Slow Flowers Podcast is engineered and edited by Andrew and Hannah Brenlin. Learn more about their work at shellandtree.com.